So are you going to do 4148 first?
Yes, I am.
Okay, got your numbers. Okay.
Welcome, everybody. I will call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. We're going to go a little out of order here to accommodate our honorable colleagues who have come to participate. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill 4148.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4148 has to do with the change in calculation for repayment used by the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program. It would change the payment from a payment on compound interest to a payment on simple interest, and this would take effect on payments that are made after property tax year starting July 1st, 2016. The revenue impact to this bill would not be realized until 2016 and amounts to $650,000 less in the program in the 15-17 biennium, and then $850,000 less in the program in the 2017-19 biennium. The fiscal impact statement is mostly no fiscal, provided that the core system replacement allows for this change, that Department of Revenue is conducting a replacement of their systems, and this could be just implemented in the reprogramming that's already being done. And so the measure was amended on the House side to apply it really to even portions of payments that are due or that are still outstanding as of July 1st, 2016. These would be adjusted so that the interest between 2011 and 2016, as if it had been simple the entire time instead of compound. And so those changes were just began in 2011 with House Bill 2543.
Okay, let's start out with our legislative delegation sitting there in the front row here. Any other legislators in the room? Okay, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13. The objective of this bill is to help low and moderate income homeowners. This bill makes a very narrow proposal affecting one program only, the Homestead Property Tax Deferral Program. It has a provision allowing the Department of Revenue to charge interest on money that's owed to the state. The interest on that money, along with every other program in the state that we can find, was calculated on simple interest until 2011. That year, changing the method of calculation from simple to compound was one of several changes to the program to make the program more solvent. The interest rate was changed, and it indeed brought in some more revenue. So over the years, it raised more money, but really not that much. And this change was described by a report, Legislative Revenue Office, as having the least impact on helping the program compared to the other changes that were made to the program. The program is now on sound footing again. This bill, as described by committee staff, says that the interest simply would change back from compound to simple. It would then, once again, match every other program in the state, which is calculated on simple interest. I want to thank the representative from West Salem who helped craft the amendment to make it more compatible with the Department of Revenue core system replacement. While this change does indeed mean there is some less interest income to the program, it will not seriously compromise the health of the program, but it really could mean a lot to seniors who are operating on a fixed income and managing a tight household budget. So I hope you will approve the request to adopt the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, David Gomberg, House District 10 on the Central Oregon Coast. And I want to thank Representative Nathanson for bringing this bill forward. Much of the impetus for this measure was a constituent of mine who called and was very concerned that compound interest was eroding the value of her home and she would have very little left to either sell or leave to her disabled daughter. And while I'm not sure the numbers entirely bear out all of her concerns, I think the point does remain that compound interest on this program sends the wrong message to low-income seniors and to disabled people who are relying on this program to remain independent in their own homes with security and with dignity. The purpose of the program, of course, is to keep them independent there. I describe the property tax deferral program as a reverse mortgage on property taxes. We adjusted that program in 2011 to try and to solidify the program and make sure that funds are available going forward into the future. The program is sound. It's solvent. The compound interest that we're charging now is not going to make the difference in the future between keeping it solvent and alternatively weakening the program. I think we just need to send a solid message to our seniors and disabled population that we want them to remain in their homes. We want this program to remain affordable, and that we don't want it to be the only program in the state that collects compound interest. So we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, and thank you for coming on this. As you'll recall, in 2011, it wasn't just trying to get the program more stable. It was trying to save the program. We actually took the unprecedented step of borrowing money from the state school fund. The situation was that dire. And so we, with the leadership of the representative from West Salem, Representative Berger, we made a number of changes that look pretty draconian, except when you compare them to other states who were also in the recession, had similar programs, and closed their program down. So our goal was to get the program back on a sustainable footing. But it's never been the intent of this program to be a profit center. Because, number one, when it does start to get more money into it, the legislature tends to raid that money. You're on the Ways and Means Committee. You know exactly what I'm talking about. And that was a big – that past history was a big part of why the program was in trouble in the first place. So for a lot of reasons, it really makes sense to keep the program in balance, to balance the needs of the seniors with the sustainability of the program. So we've made a number of tweaks since 2011. We've added back people who had a reverse mortgage, and we've made some other changes to really try to open it up as much as we could without threatening its viability. So I appreciate your bringing this. This is probably the last policy change I can see. Maybe there's more, but this seems like a very positive one, especially since it matches it up to how other programs collect interest. So thank you for bringing this forward, Representative Nathanson and Gomberg. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, John Mullen and Rick Bennett, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I think that what the representatives presented, and Madam Chair, your response and talking about the history, the only thing that I would add to it is that in working on this since 2011, I would just say that the leadership here in this committee and in the House committee has been extraordinary about saving the program, making sure was going to be on sure footing, and then the steps that were added in 2012 and 2013 to allow some additional people back into the program. I just think that that's really been, in essence, managing the program to its appropriate purpose. And the other thing that I would add is, if my memory serves me correctly, we have had nothing but unanimous votes on all of the changes going back to 2011 when those draconian kind of changes were necessary to make. But then also with the additions of adding people back into the program. And so just in concluding my remarks, would just say this is just seems like a simple matter of fairness to get to an interest rate that's akin to the way we charge interest in other programs. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. Also, as John has indicated, we think that the details of the bill have already been covered by others, so I just want to be here to indicate our support for House Bill 4148A. And again, as John did, we really appreciate the time and effort that all of you have put forth related to this program and in fact saving the program. We understand how difficult those decisions were. We supported those decisions in 2011, and we have supported your work on this program since then, and we really appreciate everything you've done. Thank you.
Thank you. And the two of you have both been really good partners. 2011 was really one of the most brutal sessions in this area and a number of other areas when we were just on the ropes economically, and hard decisions had to be made, and you both were excellent partners during that process. Mm-hmm. Questions? All right, thank you. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4148 and open a work session on House Bill 4148. Senator George.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4148A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 4148A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Rosenbaum, would you like to carry this?
That's what I get for being late.
That's right. That's right.
Late. Yes, I'd be glad to.
Thank you. Okay, now I'm going to fire up my computer here. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 4039.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4039 would clarify that the property tax exemption for a nonprofit corporation that was used by low-income housing and low-income residents would be applicable under the charitable, literary, and scientific organization property tax exemption. Most properties around the state are receiving the exemption, and so recently there's been a court case involving a couple of entities that were providing this type of housing, and the case is on appeal to the Supreme Court. This would add a sunset to the exemption of July 1st, 2018, at which time there is expected to be some reworking of the statutes around the nonprofit housing and the ability of nonprofits to participate in housing exemption or property tax exemption programs for providing this housing. And so this measure would apply to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2012. So there is, in the first biennium, considerable backdating in 1315 to reflect those 2 years of property tax. The revenue impact is thought to be $11.6 million to $46.41 million in 1315, and that's a range. It's not really known how many of the properties receiving the charitable, literary, and scientific organization exemption are these nonprofit housing, but the estimate's between 5 and 25%. In 2015-17, the revenue loss is estimated to be between $8.36 million and $33.45 million, and 17-19 is thought to be negative $4 million to negative $17.74 million, and that reflects that sunset date. Also, it's worth noting that the revenue impact could be zero depending on the outcome of the court case if they're found to be eligible for the nonprofit exemption. Though they provide low-income housing, then the revenue impact of this measure would be zero. There is a fiscal impact of zero. There's no expenditure impact associated with this measure.
So just to clarify on the revenue impact, the money will be... But that much money will be lost to the counties, but if the court decision turns out that they are covered, then we don't count it as a revenue impact because that's already the law. Is that correct?
Correct. The loss will be associated with the court decision and not the measure.
Okay. We have Jim Seymour and Jessica Adamson signed up. Gil, you're not signed up. Did you want to?
I've got their back.
Okay. Well, come on, I want you to come up and say that. You, come on, if you're on the same side, come on up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Seymour. I'm the Executive Director of Catholic Community Services Foundation. Catholic Community Services is a private nonprofit social service organization. We also provide high-quality, affordable housing. We serve about 2,000 children, adults, and families each year in six counties in the Mid-Willamette Valley and Central Coast. And about 100 of those families live in the affordable housing that we provide. I included in our testimony just an article that we were featured in the City of Salem, the urban development. I wanted to just share the story here about Sonia. Sonia came to us first as a foster child when she was 13 years old and lived in one of our what we call forever home communities, and basically was raised in one of our homes. From there, she moved into a transitional housing for kids aging out of foster care. When she got pregnant as a young adult, she's been able to come back and to live in one of our affordable housing facilities where she was able to finish high school. She's able to work, and she's paying taxes now. Just a real example of what our work is able to accomplish. The issue that we've had is that the way we've been able to put the business model together to provide this kind of housing is that we raise and about half of the money from private donors and also from grants from like the City of Salem here. We borrow about half of the money, and with the money that we receive like from the urban development, it comes with restrictions about the amount of rent that we can actually charge. So our whole business model is sort of set up just to break even. And when the change came that we were actually started to have to pay taxes on these properties, it's just thrown that upside down, so that these programs are really, really at risk. So that was the reason that we led the effort to adopt House Bill 4039A, just because it would provide some certainty for us for the future as we kind of work through a more long-term solution for this issue. And at this time, I'd like to if I may, turn it over to Jessica Adams, who can give you a little more background on the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here on behalf of Catholic Community Services. This bill really began, as Legislative Revenue Office staff indicated, with a court case, Corvallis Neighborhood Housing Services versus Linn County. And in that case, Corvallis Neighborhood Housing Services applied to Linn County for a property tax exemption under the broader nonprofit statute, ORS 307-130. And that application had been denied. Catholic Community Services, likewise, had applied for such an exemption in Marion County. And like Corvallis Neighborhood Housing Services, we already operated many of the units that Jim just talked about, and that those property tax exemptions, and very similar kinds of housing, all the facts were the same, had been granted in the past, and this new application had been denied. Corvallis Neighborhood Housing Services got to the tax court first, and the tax court, in looking at this case, saw a unique conflict between the broader nonprofit statute and Oregon's landlord-tenant law. The nonprofit exemption under 130 requires that the entity have actual exclusive use or occupancy of the property in the furtherance of its mission in order to qualify for the exemption under 307-130. When nonprofit low-income housing providers like CCS, like Corvallis Neighborhood Housing Services, provide rent, provide space for tenants, they are required to have lease agreements in place. And those lease agreements, per landlord-tenant law, provide some use and occupancy rights to the tenants. Therefore, the nonprofits no longer have exclusive use or occupancy because the tenants are the subject of the charity, not the charity itself. So the tax court, though arguing some sympathy for the position of Corvallis Neighborhood Housing Services, noted that the statute, as unclear as it was, appeared on its face to prevent nonprofits from being that provide low-income housing from qualifying under that exclusive use or occupancy standard. The case is on appeal to the Supreme Court, and in the meantime, what House Bill 4039 is designed to do is to maintain status quo. So what the bill, in essence, does is say if you had a property tax exemption in place as of the 2012 tax year, under this 307-130 statute, and it's for a nonprofit provider of low-income housing, you get to keep it. If you didn't have one in place, you don't get one under this bill. So there's no bringing folks in who didn't have an exemption in place, and there's no taking away of exemptions for folks that did. These properties are not taxed today, so the goal is until July 1, 2018, nothing would change for them. And the reason for that is to give ourselves some time to allow the courts to work through the court case, for us to see what the outcome is. For Catholic Community Services, we hope that they reject the opinion of the tax court, but that's to be decided. The important thing about this legislation is that it does not change the facts of the case for Corvallis Neighborhood Housing Services, and frankly, it doesn't change the facts for Catholic Community Services either. Neither of our denials are going to be overturned as a result of the passage of this legislation, which importantly ensures that the court will move forward and decide the Corvallis Neighborhood Housing case, which we believe is important for them to resolve this. What we know is after that court case is resolved, we may have work to do, which is why the sunset date is out to the beginning of the 2018 tax year. That allows us to work with the counties and work with other stakeholders to really find a way to address this issue, again, with an eye on ensuring that entities like Catholic Community Services and really many, many others around the state that have relied on the charitable scientific ORS 307-130 exemption are able to continue forward in a financially viable way to offer these services, knowing that they had relied on those exemptions for years. We have worked closely with the counties and appreciate their efforts to find common ground on this, and the Dash 1 amendment that was adopted in the House. We'll let Gil testify to this, but we believe we have reached accommodation on both sides. We also appreciate the work of a variety of other nonprofits, including the Housing Alliance, who provide us a lot of technical assistance and support as we develop this bill. We appreciate all of the work, and we're happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, so the court case involves a facility in Corvallis.
Correct.
But I'm hearing you say that the decision will affect others as well, and those others will also, if they had their tax exemption, they'll also be covered by this bill.
That's correct. And again, only if you had one in place as of the 2012 tax year. Mm-hmm. Corvallis Neighborhood Housing Services did not, on one of the Catholic Community Services properties or Statesman property, we did not. So importantly, and this was a key point for the counties and that we've agreed on, this bill will not fix those cases. It does not overturn. It doesn't give somebody something they didn't already have. And that wasn't what we were out to do. We didn't want to cost the counties resources that they were already currently collecting, and this bill does not do that.
Okay. Gil, why don't you say a few words, and then we'll open it to questions.
I'm Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties.
This is an area of the law. It's not unusual that it's difficult to interpret, and there is in the same chapter, ORS Chapter 307, a series on that provide exemptions for nonprofit low-income housing, and these folks may have qualified there. So there's, I think the judicial decision will inform what the issues are that we have to address in this chapter, ORS chapter. We intend in good faith to sit down and work it out so that low-income housing is very important to communities in Oregon. It's a necessary part of communities. So we didn't want to see the disruption going forward until the court case is decided. So we agree with this bill and ask you to support it.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? All right. Thank you. We have nobody else signed up. Does anybody else want to talk? Nobody else wants to talk. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4039 and open a work session on House Bill 4039. Senator George.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4039 and Gross to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 4039A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, just question for staff, I guess. I guess I don't understand why there's such a range in the revenue impact. I don't, and maybe I should have asked this when the counties were up here, but don't they have to know when a property is exempt, whether it's a literary or scientific organization or whether it's a charitable organization providing housing?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, the tax expenditure, when the report is made, is on aggregate from the county assessors. And so that information, though it was once separated on the rolls, is aggregated again for the reporting. So,
but the assessors must have on the rolls what type of property it is.
That's
right?
True. The individual assessors do have that,
but is this
the point at which
is this because? Excuse me for interrupting. Is this because you don't have a way of parsing out which ones were there before 2012 and which ones weren't?
Well, this is. I did not have a way of parsing out how many of the 307-120 exemptions were. Were nonprofit housing versus museums or other types of libraries and other recipients of this exemption. There was no way to go. The information is not collected at the county level. It's collected in aggregate by the Department of Revenue for the tax expenditure report and is not separated that way.
So it's only the housing element that is at issue here, and the others that are in the aggregate are not
affected by this. Okay. That's true.
Well, that's interesting. Does that answer your
well,
question?
Well, it does. It just would help if we didn't have such a big range in 13-15, because if you think that this could go up to $46 million and that money would come from schools and then from counties, it looks a lot worse than if you think it's at the low end. And it looks like we calculated this being a range of 5% to 20% of the total amount. And so we came up with that as just sort of our best guess of how much of it is housing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, correct.
Is there any way to hone it more specifically?
It would take probably a survey of individual counties to even say which properties were being exempt and how much value was exempt under this program. And it would take more of an individualized survey, and even then I'm not sure that the information is available. I'd have to speak with assessors.
But this is, and this is a weird one, because this is not money, this is not a reduction from money that's actually ever been collected, right? This is money that would otherwise go to, if we do nothing, it will go to them until the court decides. But they haven't been getting this money, so it's not, have they received any money under this tax court ruling?
Madam Chair, the assessors, if the court ruling does change, and they find that this is no longer taxable. The assessors will go on doing as they have done, which is exempting these properties, except for that one case. So this is really a question of what they do in the meantime while the case is in court. They may be assessing these properties, or they may not, and it's really up to the individual judgment at this point. But this is just the amount that would be applicable based on.
But the situation that didn't make it in to the deadline, that it's going to be taxed despite this bill, if the court rules in favor of Catholic Charities lawsuit, then that property also will not be taxed. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Those numbers that are up there, is that the value of the properties or is that the tax amounts?
That would be the tax amounts.
And it's property tax.
All right, property tax. So anytime you have follow-up, I guess anytime, I'm kind of a Senator Rosenbaum there, when you have that big of a spread, that just tells you you don't know.
Any other questions? All right. Okay. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4039. I already do that. I'll open a work session on House Bill. Did you move it already?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there any objection to...
We're in motion. We're just waiting for the vote.
Okay, we are in work session, and Senator George has moved House Bill 4039A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. The chair needs more sleep. Is there any discussion, any objection? So ordered. Senator Baer, Jr., this would be a good challenge for you to carry.
That challenge may be an understatement.
Okay. I'm still so bad at all this. Okay, now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 4003.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4003 is the annual Reconnect Bill. In contrast to prior sessions, there's not much going on in this bill this time. There wasn't anything that really happened in Congress that affected the IRC last year.
Anything else?
So the revenue impact is a no impact, and this is the first time I've actually issued a no impact for a Reconnect bill. And the fiscal impact is a no impact. And it simply moves the connection date from January 3rd, 2013 to December 31st, 2013. And as a reminder, usually this is a December 31 date. We had the January 3rd date to tie to ATRA, which Congress passed January 1st or January 2nd of 2013. And that's really all there is to the bill. There is a dash one amendment.
Okay. We have Gail Rydell signed up again to talk about the dash one.
I can discuss the dash
one. Oh, would you like to discuss?
Yeah, sure. Madam Chair and Committee, the dash one, yesterday afternoon I went out to McMinnville for a totally unrelated business issue, was at and had a meeting at the Evergreen Aviation Museum. And as you know, Mr. Dell Smith, who owned Evergreen Aviation, has invested each one of those buildings, just the buildings alone, are about $30 million investment for this beautiful air museum that we have in Yamhill County. And brought in the Spruce Goose at a huge cost and has brought in all kinds of amazing, if you haven't been out there, it's a beautiful location, it's a beautiful site. About 500,000 Oregon visitors go out to the Aviation Air Museum each year. In the last few months, unfortunately, there's been a financial collapse of the Evergreen Airlines and related companies. And Mr. Smith was basically donating all of these things out of his estate, and all of the cash flow to the museum has, in essence, come dependent on other types of donations. So the Smithsonian and other have become partners with the Aviation Air Museum. But in the midst of all of this financial crisis, the Yamhill County Assessor's Office took what many view as a very, very strange interpretation of the tax code on the, similar to the previous bill we had, on the issue of what is covered by the property tax exemption for scientific entities. The problem is that Mr. Smith, when he built these, had looked at the law in a plain way and had not asked for any kind of special exemption. He was just following the law, and the county approved it, and it's this huge thing. And now the tax code has been, in essence, been interpreted differently, and there is sitting right now almost a $1 million tax bill newly assigned to the museum. The problem is the museum is at the cusp of being turned over. And if we don't do something quickly, it very likely could be out of business by as early as the end of this year. Unbeknownst to me, because it's not my district, Representative Widener on the other side introduced a bill, and I assumed it would fly through very quickly because this is a huge asset for the state of Oregon, and it was stopped over there. And so I requested yesterday, a call from McMinnville, requested staff to have some amendments drafted up to some different bills that the relating clauses were close, and basically put this issue on the table now. This is a treasure that we have been given. Unfortunately, now Mr. Smith doesn't have the financial resources to continue to back it up. But other private parties are willing to step up. We just have to maintain the tax status they've been getting up to this time. And so I've introduced the Dash 1s. It may not be appropriate to pursue them right at this exact time, but it is an issue that I would strongly suggest the committee consider before the close of the legislative session, because you may not have this opportunity in January when we come back.
And I appreciate you explaining that. I think it's, we talked about this before, it's a bit of a stretch for this particular bill. I think it's an issue that the committee needs to be aware of, and I will talk it over with my counterpart on the House side. We meet regularly and see what the situation was over there, and pursue it with you if the committee is interested. So we no longer have a Dash 1 amendment to worry about, but go ahead.
Are you withdrawing your...
No. It's still here. Oh. It's still here. No, nothing ever dies in this process until signing die.
I am signed up to speak.
Yeah. Well, if you'd like to discuss it, come on. Come on.
Yes. I submitted electronic testimony to you, but about 15 minutes before 1 o'clock. I'm here to urge you to reject the Dash 1 amendments, and I can talk about
what happened. Okay, well, let's get you on the record before you start talking.
Sorry. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I will leave to the council whether the Dash 1s are germane to the bill itself and whether the Dash 1s fit into the relating clause. I want to address the policy issue. The Dash 1 amendments resurrect a policy issue that's already been set aside by the House Revenue Committee. You've heard that. The bill there would have amended the property tax exemption statute that's difficult to interpret, and in fact it's the same statute you just discussed in the context of House Bill 4039. By broadening the exemption with more vague language that likely would lead to even more litigation, the Dash 1 amendments would create a new statute, adding to the confusion by mixing the federal tax income tax code and the state property tax code, and would adopt the same vague language that was in House Bill 4106, which will likely cause more litigation. I've listed four examples with questions about that. Grants an exemption to the museum, the land on which the museum is situated, including open land, but does not provide a limit on acreage. Grants an exemption to property used in conjunction with public displays of the museum, and I wonder if this includes a water park, which the Oregonian reports is billed as the America's only educational water park. There's question about the exemption for goods and services providing refreshment to the public. Does that include catered private events, which occur there?
and the exemption for the theater. Question is, how frequently must the theater be actually used for educational purposes, and what if it's used for other purposes? This bill would override any non-final judicial rulings on appeals beginning after on or after July 1, 2011. This would deal directly with appeals of denials by Yamhill County with the backing of Department of Revenue of exemptions on the Evergreen Museum related property. There are 9 of these in tax court and at magistrate level, and they amount to $400,000 in taxes for public services that are in dispute. Legislation that's property specific very seldom results in good public policy. AOC agrees with the conclusion of Chair Phil Barnhart in the House, who stated that the legislature should leave the courts alone to do their work and let the appeals finish. Let's learn from the appeals and address as a whole these statutes, make them more understandable, more easier to implement. And then one final note generally, this is specific to this particular situation, but generally remember that new property tax exemptions under our property tax system are a straight loss of revenue for education and public services, and statewide 44% of the property taxes fund education. If that funding is lost, then the general fund must backfill the shortfalls. So that, Madam Chair, I'm answering any questions.
Thank you. It's my understanding, and I don't know if you'd answer this or Senator George, but this wasn't taxed in the past, and then the policy changed, and being taxed?
Madam Chair, did not have it on the House. We had the Deputy Yamhill County Assessor. He would be able to answer that immediately and directly. I don't know. I think not, but I'd be guessing.
So
I'm not the primary source.
You don't remember what he said? You were there.
He did not address that specific question, as I recall.
Madam Chair, while I'm sitting up here, I'm getting text messages from members of the Yamhill County Commission who disagree with the county assessor, and I think the issue is that's everybody's understanding. What happened is there's been a much more aggressive view of reviewing the Evergreen Aviation Museum, and it has created this issue. And I want to stress, having the Spruce Goose here and that particular is such a unique benefit for the state of Oregon, and Yamhill County is very, very eager to have it stay there. And I know there's a disagreement between a very aggressive county assessor in Yamhill County and pretty much everybody else in Yamhill County. But sometimes assessors make wrong decisions, and when it has statewide impact like this, I think it becomes a statewide issue.
But it is in court?
Yes.
Right now?
And that's the problem. And the problem we have is, honestly, with this particular museum, because people are rallying around right now, in the past, the museum could take this kind of hit because you had a benefactor who was huge, willing to put money in. But unfortunately, that no longer exists, and this collapse has happened over the last 4 months. Of the entire Evergreen fortune. So one of the things I think is really important is the legacy of that was a huge gift to the state, which was done really all with private money. And I'm just based on the building structures alone, you have approaching of $100 million gift to the state of Oregon that is now in jeopardy over things such as these property taxes, which prior to this were not taxed. And this is not something that literally, the banks are rolling in to talk about repossession of some of the assets in the museum as part of an overall. And so this is why this particular thing is so vitally important. And I understand the big issues of there's a court case going on, but sometimes when you look at something, this is why we have special session or have annual sessions now.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Is there anything that was in conflict with your understanding with that Senator George just characterized?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we had a vote within AOC about this, and the 2 Yamhill County commissioners who were there split. So the text, I don't know who's sending the text, but certainly there's some support.
I will tell you that the county commissioner that texted me pretty much has a lot of pull with me, so
yeah.
good Commissioner George is stressing that there are likely a majority of the county commission that want this.
Yeah.
And since the good Commissioner George is saying this is a very high priority, And I think that the idea is on this thing is that this is a this is one of those things that goes above any kind of political thing. It really needs to be done, and I'm worried about the legacy here.
Well, I'd like to continue the discussion. I don't think it fits in this bill. I wouldn't want to take a risk on our reconnect bill with trying to put something questionable in. So I don't want to keep this on the table for this bill. I am interested. We'll pursue the conversation. Chris?
Madam Chair.
Who was talking? Oh, okay. Yeah, come on. Come on, Jim. You've been sitting back there like a little wallflower.
I have a short question for Gil.
Oh, Gil, do you want to come back? We have a short question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gil, you know, I kind of understand what you're talking about, the county's losing some property taxes, and we probably don't want to. But the other side of the coin is, right now the county's not getting any property tax from here. If the museum goes away, the county's not going to get any property tax.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Bertschinger, I understand that. The issue has to do with adjoining activities rather than the museum itself, as I understand it. And if I had a little more time than just, you know, half an hour, I would have had the person here who's been involved in all nine appeals. Evergreen has lost on appeal at the magistrate level, and there's value in getting to the end of this. So,
okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam
Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I hadn't planned on getting up, so I apologize. I heard some comments. I thought it might be useful to the department to weigh in. We are assisting Yamhill County with the prosecution or response to the claims on this particular case in these nine cases. And I think it would be fair to say that the facts of the actual situation are before the court. They're not really here before this committee. We could go into a lot of detail about the use of each of the accounts, what happens on each of the accounts, what property is involved with each of the accounts, but that's not really here before you. It is before the court, so I think it would be hard to make any kind of conclusions about, in your minds anyway, without that information. And, you know, working with the county assessor, they are trying to determine what is, you know, what in this property is used for scientific purposes, what's a museum, and what is not. That's not always an easy decision, as it might be suggested that the county assessor is being very aggressive. It could also be said that the taxpayer or the nonprofit is being very creative. And I think what you'll find in the literally thousands and thousands of applications the assessors get every year is that people are very creative in what they think is charitable, is religious, is scientific, and on and on and on. We have a case in Yamhill County also by a company called Catland, and they have some fencing outside their home on 20 acres, and they have 20 feral cats. And they've claimed, and it's gone to tax court, that this should be exempt under the charitable exemption. So it is interesting. No one's really disputing that.
I could exempt my house.
We spend some really good resources on some really not too useful things, unfortunately, because of the creativity out there. I think no one would disagree that what happens at Evergreen Museum is useful and scientific, and that a museum is a very valuable thing. Is everything that occurs there exempt? We don't think so. Not everything. And so understand that the county assessor isn't saying that everything is taxable. It's not that simple. And we're working to find an answer to your policy that's in the current law.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. That's helpful. Senator George.
I think that what he's alluding to is the issue of the gift shop, lunch counter, and the IMAX theater. And I think one of the issues in comparison is if you go to Multnomah County, OMSI has a museum which is set up almost exactly the same way, which has a IMAX theater, which has lunch counters, which has gift shops, and it's not on tax rolls.
Madam Chair, is that a question to me?
Is it on the tax rolls?
I cannot answer that question. I heard about this amendment about 12:30, and the assessor could not be here for.
And Madam Chair, it's not. Just because I was answering. Yeah,
I don't
I
know.
the answer, and the problem is that you have this different treatment in this situation, and I'm just saying, in this very unique situation, it is very, very. I mean, when I learned about this yesterday, that this was not moving forward, it's very concerning. I think to everybody involved with how it's being treated uniquely.
Senator, do you have a question?
I just want to say, if OMSI is subject to these kinds of exemptions and the Air Museum, I do, that is something that does resonate with me, that perhaps we should look at this. However, it's a lot to bite off in a short session, especially since we're sort of on the other side of, it's not the 11th hour yet, but we're into the evening. And but that is a legitimate question. OMSI gets one treatment and the Air Museum gets something else.
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, we totally agree with that. And if they're identically being used for the same purposes, they should be treated the same.
Yeah.
We agree with that.
And there would be constitutional. The Constitution would have some things to say about that as well.
Absolutely.
Because
Thank
it's
you.
Not subject to Measure 50. That's why.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, this is an interesting discussion. It's we're not. There's a lot more information that needs to come Absolutely. Forward. All right. I'm gonna hang on to this just till the next meeting.
Okay.
So I'm gonna close the public hearing on House Bill 4003, which has got to be the most boring bill I've ever seen in my life. And we're gonna hold on to it because of the subject matter. So we will close that public hearing, and now our agenda calls for an informational meeting from the Department of Revenue on out-of-state tax shelters and licensed tax compliance.
What did we ever do to you?
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that you will recall House Bill 2460 from the 13th session. Though it came in a number of different forms, this is the bill that was the a tax haven bill that required taxpayers to submit a form to Department of Revenue if they had income reported from specific tax jurisdictions. Well, there was another element to the bill as it came over to you from the House, and that remained in the bill, and you approved it. It is required the Department of Revenue to come back to you with a report on out-of-state tax shelters. So looking not only at the tax havens and tax haven countries, but also the possibility of tax shelters within the United States. So Jeff Henderson is here from Department of Revenue, and the report that the department's put together is on OLIS for you, and Jeff's going to go through that with you.
Great. Welcome.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Henderson. I am the Corporation Tax Policy Coordinator at the Department of Revenue. And as Paul indicated, I'm here today to discuss the out-of-state tax shelters report, House Bill 2460, that came out of the 2013 regular session. I plan to quickly run through the report and discuss the methods that the department has identified as methods by which corporations shift income that is otherwise taxable to Oregon outside the state, and then we'll answer any questions. Please feel free to jump in, though, if as questions come up. As required by House Bill 2460, the department prepared a report on out-of-state tax shelters. The focus of that report is on corporation income tax shelters, and the report was divided into two categories: international tax shelters that generally reduce both federal and state tax liabilities for Oregon purposes. That's due to our tie to federal taxable income and also the federal corporate filing method, Water's Edge filing method, that generally includes just the income of corporations located in the United States, and then also domestic U.S. tax shelters that generally only impact state tax liabilities. The report addresses both abusive and legitimate tax shelters and shows that there's a fine line between the two, but that the tax implications are very different. Abusive shelters are illegal and potentially subject to increased penalties, whereas legitimate shelters are statutorily allowed and viewed as effective tax planning. jumping into the international tax shelters, the obvious objective for corporate income tax planning is to minimize tax liabilities. For multinational corporations, those that do business globally, have related corporations that do business globally, one way they can accomplish that is to structure activities so that a maximum amount of profits are sourced to low tax or no tax jurisdictions, and maximize the amount of expenses, make sure they're allocated to high tax jurisdictions such as the United States. International tax shelters are not realistically available to all corporations. They are typically limited to larger multi-state or multinational corporations that have the resources available to create or relocate an affiliate in a foreign jurisdiction. Some background, some very quick background on the federal tax provisions at issue. U.S. corporations are subject to U.S. tax on all income, including the income earned abroad. However, U.S. multinational corporations generally can defer U.S. tax on income, active business income that is earned through a controlled foreign corporation, until that income is repatriated, brought back into the United States, and typically would be taxed as a dividend. Deferral, though, is generally prohibited for passive income, inherently mobile income, such as dividends, interest, and royalties, under the federal subpart F provisions. Income reported under subpart F provisions is subject to U.S. tax regardless of whether or not it's repatriated. So at the time the income is earned, the U.S. shareholder of the CFC would report that as taxable income. Again, the subpart F income. International tax shelters have received significant attention recently, with headlines focused on the profits maintained, the corporate profits maintained offshore. In March of 2013, the Wall Street Journal reported that their analysis of 60 U.S.-based multinational corporations found that those 60 maintained a combined profit of $166 billion offshore for 2012 alone. The Wall Street Journal reported the trend was most pronounced among the 26 technology and healthcare corporations in the survey, stating that many of the tech and healthcare companies have shifted intellectual property, such as patents and marketing rights, to subsidiaries in low-tax or no-tax foreign jurisdictions, allowing the sales and profits related to that intangible property to be recorded in those low-tax jurisdictions. The analysis showed those 26 corporations collectively reported $120 billion of the profits overseas for 2012 alone, which accounted for nearly three-quarters of the total. The Wall Street Journal analysis, however, did not address, of those profits, which percentage was attributable to abusive tax shelters. It didn't distinguish between that. The Oregon State Public Interest Research Group Foundation, the Osberg Foundation, in January of 2013, released a report that addressed the revenue impact of offshore tax shelters. That foundation estimates that Oregon loses $283 million annually of corporate tax revenues to offshore tax havens. The Osberg Foundation report, however, did not address, though, what percentage would be attributable to abusive tax shelters. The U.S. Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations undertook a review of the offshore tax avoidance schemes by three of the largest U.S.-based multinational corporations, Microsoft, Hewlett-Packard, and Apple. The subcommittee released its findings from the two-part case study late in 2012 and then in 2013. The subcommittee identified provisions in the code that allow these corporations to shift intellectual property offshore to a related affiliate in low-tax or no-tax foreign country, in part to avoid or reduce U.S. taxes on the profits generated by these assets. Defer U.S. taxation on offshore passive income that's generally prohibited under the subpart F provisions, but there were they identified exceptions in the code that allowed them to defer taxation on that income. And also, they identified provisions in the code that allowed these multinationals to effectively repatriate foreign profits, return those profits back to the United States to run U.S. operations without subjecting the foreign profits to U.S. tax. And that was pointed out through a use of a short-term loan exception, exception in the code. The specific transactions, international transactions, identified in the U.S. Senate case study were not labeled as abusive, but rather generally referred to as transactions allowed under federal law. However, there was written testimony submitted to the subcommittee that suggests some of the specific transactions reviewed as part of the study appeared on the surface to conflict with some common law doctrines. Endnote, I believe it was endnote 24 in the report, speaks to that and identifies where that testimony came from. So anti-abuse common law doctrines, the line between abusive and legitimate tax shelters is often unclear unless a transaction is found to conflict with a specific statutory provision. Oftentimes, a determining factor falls to review of the transaction under common law doctrines. The anti-abuse common law doctrines for tax law purposes were created by the courts and traced back to the 1930s. These doctrines are used to evaluate transactions where the language of the law does not directly address a specific scenario or where a scenario is addressed, but there is question as to whether the transaction complies with the purpose of the statute. Historically, there are three common law doctrines that the IRS has used to address transactions. One, the substance of a form doctrine. Two, the business purpose doctrine. And finally, the economic substance doctrine. The impact of international tax shelters on Oregon corporate tax revenues, there definitely is a there's undoubtedly an impact on Oregon corporate tax revenues, but the department is not able to determine the extent of that impact. Because there is such a fine line between abusive and legitimate, and it takes a detailed analysis of each transaction, we're not able to determine that impact. So moving to the domestic tax shelters, the domestic shelters addressed in this report also involve transactions with related corporations. And oftentimes, the related corporation is incorporated in a tax haven state, such as Wyoming or Nevada, states that do not impose a corporate income tax, or the state of Delaware, which it does impose a corporate income tax. However, it doesn't tax income of a corporation whose only activity in the state is the ownership, maintenance, and management of intangible property. These transactions are used by multi-state corporations to either shift income out of the tax base or to reduce their income apportionment percentage and minimize their tax liabilities.
Senator George.
Because of that, do you view Delaware and Delaware is different than Nevada and Wyoming? I mean, if Delaware and if Nevada and Wyoming don't have a corporate tax, is that different than what Delaware is doing legally? Or,
Madam Chair, Senator George. You know, different. I'm not sure about different. I think there's definitely advantages of doing business in Delaware. There's huge exemptions that or sources of income that Delaware doesn't tax for corporations. The report goes on. It's got a section dedicated to, I believe, Delaware in the report, and talks about the number of U.S. corporations that are incorporated in Delaware and the benefits there that Delaware offer, but different, I'm not sure.
I guess, Madam Chair, my point is that Wyoming and Nevada just don't have a corporate income tax. They don't apply it to anybody, including corporations that operate inside their own states. That's just their tax code. So they have some kind of advantage. And that seems different than a tax haven like Delaware, where they basically exempt out income. You see what I'm saying? Where you send income there, and they treat businesses inside their state different than those who are using it as a tax haven. Do you see the? I was wondering if there was any analysis of that.
I do, Madam Chair. Senator George, I do see that. I think as part of this research, it did come up quite a few times, you know, the state of Wyoming was referred to as a tax haven state, and maybe not looking at it so much from in-state corporations or just the fact that that's their state law, but just the fact that out-of-state corporations can so easily incorporate in Wyoming, and maybe lack of transparency with some of the laws around Wyoming. I think folks have looked at Wyoming and said, this is a tax haven state, you know, and kind of meets to some of the definitions when folks start thinking about international tax havens. Some of those same types of criteria apply to some of this Wyoming.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. So two common domestic tax shelter strategies that rely on transactions with unitary affiliates that the department pointed out in this report involve transactions related passive investment companies or trademark holding companies and asset management companies. The passive investment company strategy typically involves a transfer of an operating company's trademark or trade name to a separate incorporated subsidiary. The operating company is entitled to a royalty expense deduction for the payments made to the passive investment company for use of the trademarks, and the operating company can further reduce its taxable income by borrowing money from the passive investment company and deducting the interest payments made. States have challenged the trademark holding company transactions in a couple different ways. Asserting economic nexus for the passive investment company and disallowing the transaction based on economic substance doctrine. The states have received mixed results in the courts for both of those paths. The second domestic tax shelter the department identified was asset management companies. Similar to the passive investment company arrangement, the asset management company strategy involves transactions with the related affiliate. A common transaction typically involves a transfer of an income-producing intangible asset, such as a mortgage-backed security from a financial institution as part of a loan participation agreement to a unitary affiliate that oftentimes might be located in a tax haven state. For working purposes, if the asset management company is not included in the same federal return, the interest income that's received following the transfer of the asset to the asset management company would be excluded from the Oregon tax base. If the asset management company is included in the same federal return, the tax base would not be impacted, but likely that the Oregon apportionment percentage would be reduced, as that interest income now being received by the asset management company would not be sourced to Oregon. So those are the two methods that the department identified for the domestic tax shelters. That was the very quick run-through of the report. Are there any questions?
Questions from the committee. Do you have any comments on the report, Dr. Warner?
Madam Chair, yes. There are some recommendations that are included for your review at the end in terms of kind of some general strategies. We did talk a bit in the House Revenue Committee about the proposal to codify the economic substance doctrine, and I know House Revenue Chair is very interested in looking at that. Mm-hmm. So there are some things that may suggest possible 15 decisions. And the other thing I will add too about this report, there's some very good background material in here on apportionment formulas, how they've set up, how they work, and also combined reporting, and a good discussion about Oregon's unique method of combined reporting, and that's, you know, those kinds of issues are very important in terms of understanding the overall corporate income tax, which is no small feat to understand the state corporate income tax.
No small feat at all. And so, the multi-state tax commission recommendations, what are the key ones of those?
Madam Chair, there are, not thinking of any current proposed recommendations that the Multi-State Tax Commission has out there specific to tax shelters. They do have some model statute, model regulations that kind of get to some of these issues. That recommendation was really set forth, you know, as just to make sure that the committee members are aware, as Oregon is a compact member state of the Multi-State Tax Commission, and you know, with its goal to promote uniformity amongst the states, we just wanted to have that in there. And as recommendations come up, we would maybe get them in front of the committees for consideration.
Okay, great.
I'll remind the committee that we left the multi-state tax compact and then rejoined it.
Yes, right. But we are now in it.
We are now
in it. And we're really in it now. Okay, any other questions?
So, Madam Chair, are they tackling this problem at a federal level in ways that we will be able to? Because it seems like your analysis is that a lot of what affects Oregon corporations is how they choose to file at a federal level. Mm-hmm. So are there changes afoot that maybe then Oregon would be able to piggyback on? There's a reference to uniformity with anti-abuse federal legislation, so there must be something proposed. Huh?
Right, right. Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, the proposed federal legislation that the department's aware of is not, there aren't any changes specific to the corporate filing method at the federal level, but what there are, I think there are some increased penalties for abusive transactions, more geared at some proposals, legislative proposals, to get at the transactions, the loopholes may be identified in the Internal Revenue Code by the Senate case study, but I'm not aware that there are any filing method changes at the federal level that we would pick up.
And just a follow-up, or Paul, I don't know if you were going to.
Well, I was just going to add, Senator, that in terms of federal policy around the tax haven legislation, if the federal policy were to be more aggressive, you wouldn't have needed 2460, we put it that way.
I mean, right.
In a way, what we're doing is we're saying that as a state, we are committed to a water's edge tax base for apportioning income, but there are certain exceptions to that based on these use of these tax havens. And if we had more clarification at the federal level, that would be less, probably would not be necessary.
And how, just a follow-up, how did the Osberg report come up with that figure of $283 million lost revenues attributable to offshore tax havens in Oregon?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, we had the report and looked at that, and I think we even included in our material for the discussion around 2460 in the session. It appeared to be there's a number of large corporations that were identified, and it seemed to be a very broad definition of what was a tax haven, including, you know, countries like Ireland, for example, that were not in your bill. But it was very much a top-down kind of an estimate of here's a total, and then we kind of share it down. I don't know if Jeff has a view on that, but that was my interpretation of it.
Because our actual revenue impact was considerably less than that. What was it again? I can't remember.
Madam Chair, the revenue impact was $18 million a year. So you only picked up 1 year in this biennium. So we do have it growing to about $40 million in the future biennium. So, and we do have working with the department, they will be flagging that revenue as it comes in. And so for the estimate, that may be a source of embarrassment, or it may be a source of self-congratulation. We'll see.
Kind of like forecasts.
Yes. Humbling.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your good work. Okay.
Chris is going to come up for that. We've got one more.
Is this next one long?
No.
Now we will close the informational meeting on the Oregon Tax Shelter report and open an informational meeting on the licensee tax compliance.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a follow-up to a 2009 bill, House Bill 3082, which created a pilot project for linking occupational licensees to the tax compliance. And the department has provided a couple of updated reports on that pilot project, which is scheduled to sunset. And this is just the latest update.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And as Chris just elaborated, House Bill 2871 did require us to write a report about our progress in implementing the pilot project under 2009 House Bill 3082 and provide some other information, including some recommendations on how you could potentially implement such a compliance requirement. First, in our paper, we talk a little bit about what collateral compliance is, and it's usually some sort of a sanction that happens in addition to an actual direct sanction for as a consequence. They typically possess three different characteristics. One is they apply in addition to formal tax penalties. They rescind or deny a government-provided benefit or privilege, and they are usually enforced by an agency other than the taxing authority. And that is what you see with licensee compliance. The licensor is the one that would be revoking the license, not the Department of Revenue. Examples in federal law right now for tax noncompliance, you can't get a passport, you can't get an FHA loan, you can't get a federal job or a contract if you're not in tax compliance. Of course, Oregon already has a contract. You can't get contracts in Oregon if you're not in tax compliance. In other states, there's denials of recreational licenses such as hunting permits, driver's licenses, or other professional licenses. But in Oregon, we generally rely on monetary penalties for tax noncompliance. But sometimes we're finding that those monetary penalties are not necessarily a great enough loss to the taxpayer to change their behavior. Licensee sanctions may be superior to monetary sanctions because they provoke what's called loss aversion, especially when associated with a government-provided benefit to which people feel entitled, such as a license. Licensee sanctions also promote fairness and equity. We see a lot in our enforcement. Businesses that are able to underbid on other businesses and like industries because they don't pay their taxes. They don't pay the payroll taxes, so they can afford to underbid on other businesses. So this also promotes fairness and equity. And we also know that licensees tend to be self-employed people, and we know from our 2009 tax compliance report that self-employed individuals tend to not have as much third-party reporting. And we also know that third-party reporting causes a very, very high rate of compliance. So those are things that we've learned generally about licensee compliance, tax compliance requirement. In 2009, House Bill 3082 authorized the pilot project, and initially it was very narrow in focus. We just looked at individual income tax compliance, so no business taxes. And we worked with three licensors, the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, Construction Contractors Board, and the Board of Tax Practitioners. We thought that'd probably be a good idea if they were in compliance since they're preparing tax returns. We looked at about 6,200 licenses, as you can see in the screen that you have displayed there, and checked the compliance on them. In 2009 and 10, we actively engaged the licensees from the boards through education and actual enforcement efforts. And you can see in the appendix the original report we provided. 2011 and 12, we worked on our phase two, which was basically an educational process only. And then in 2013, we didn't engage with the licensees at all in the pilot project. So as you can see, we did a baseline in 2010, December of 2010, and again, the baseline, and then we did it again after we did the enforcement, and then again in 2013. And as you can see in the chart, I believe that's on page 3 of your report, that without regular intervention or the threat of a license not being in jeopardy for tax compliance, they tend to go back to their prior behaviors. So we do believe that there is value in expanding the pilot project under House Bill 3082, because it does appear that the highest rate of compliance is when the licensee is at risk for losing his or her license. But there are some issues that we have to kind of get overcome before we recommend actually expanding it. One is we don't really, as a part of writing this report, we learned that we don't really understand the universe of licenses or licensees. There's a website out there that's hosted by the Secretary of State now, but what we found it has inaccurate or out-of-date information on it. Agencies haven't been updating it as they probably should be. And in 2013, we found that House Bill, you folks passed House Bill 2643, which requires a new Oregon license directory. which is the maintained by the Secretary of State. It requires state agencies to update that. And the first time they're going to update that information about licenses and the number of licensees they have is September of this year. So in the future, we hope that we would have better information to be able to make to understand what that licensee base is, what that universe is. Additionally, we want to leverage our technology. We understand that other states have implemented a licensee compliance check type of process, and we would like to automate that process where they could just come to us through a self-service portal and just print out a certificate that says, yes, you're in compliance, or they could say it would say, no, you're not in compliance, contact us. To help with the costs and the ease of administration for their purposes as well. Additionally, you folks know we do also have a new system coming on board, Gentex, the core system replacement, which we believe will give us better compliance tools and better data as we go forward. So our recommendation at this point in time is to go ahead and allow House Bill 3082 to sunset, which it does in 2016, right in the middle of our core system replacement initiative right now, and to revisit this in the future after we are fully implemented with the core system and the information in the new Oregon license directory is updated. We think that that'll allow us, that better data will allow us to give you better information on how you potentially could implement such a requirement and also use technology better and weigh the benefits then of licensee compliance against other tools we may have to ensure compliance. With that, if you have any questions.
I apologize for being out of the room for a minute. You may have already covered this, but is most of the compliance actually filing tax returns?
Madam Chair, most of the compliance was several parts. It was filing tax returns and it was collecting payment as well.
Okay. Do you know what kind of, because when we were first looking into this was the pretty stunning number of people who in some of these areas that didn't file tax returns at all that should have, that filed federal tax returns and didn't file state returns. I'm just trying to get a sense of the magnitude.
Madam Chair, as part of the pilot project or as part of our Secretary of State audit on filing enforcement?
It was part of the audit that the Secretary of State did, and they uncovered a lot of people who were not filing at all.
Madam Chair, that's correct. We did, at that point in time, I believe, if I recall correctly, we had shifted some of our internal resources away from filing enforcement and moved them toward collection. I think we were in a collection speed up at that point in time in our revenue stream. And so we did end up, after that audit, there was a substantial amount of non-filing reported or found by the Secretary of State. And we have, I believe, changed some of our internal policies on how, shifted some of that resource back to filing enforcement. And we've also changed some of our policies on how we actually look at filing enforcement, how many years back we go, how many taxpayers we try and hit. So we've broadened our span of who we reach out to in filing enforcement.
But when you get your new system, you'll have a much more efficient way, won't you, of telling who has filed federal returns and should be filing state returns?
Madam Chair, that's my understanding, that we'll have data that's more readily available to us and that they all talk to each other. The different data sets are able to talk to each other. That's my understanding.
I mean, really, we have high hopes for that. And given what we've been through, we have a lot of trepidation. I think the thing that this committee most liked hearing in the presentation was that this was off the shelf. Nothing fancy, no bells and whistles, just tried and true. And we're hoping that does the job for us.
Appreciate that, Madam Chair.
Senator Bertschinger.
If this committee goes forward with this, or if we go forward with this, I'd like to tell you, you know, in my business, I have to have a BOLI license. To get my BOLI license, I have to have a certificate of compliance, both federal and state, and unemployment. And the way we get those certificates is pretty antiquated and takes some time and it's pretty cumbersome. So if we go down this road, we have got to figure out a way that the company can
go to the web or something and see if they're in compliance and print out the certificate. Because right now, I've had it as much as a month and a half before I got my certificate of compliance. Mm-hmm. And it makes it kind of tough. So we need to take that consideration.
Yeah, that's good having that on-the-ground perspective. Okay, other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, that completes our business for the day. Paul, I don't see a reason why we have to meet on Friday at this point. That old house over there is just so pokey, we just can't.
Madam Chair, no, we don't have any other bills in the committee, house bills, ones you already considered. We do have two on the House floor tomorrow, mm-hmm. so I would anticipate probably having those by Monday. Right. So
we'll plan on meeting Monday, and I don't know if this is going to be the last time we're going to be able to get away without a Friday meeting, but it could be. So any other business, Paul? Okay, we are adjourned.